Hi, everyone, and welcome to DevRaga Personal Finance. My name's DevRaga, and I'm your host. And in this episode, we will continue with the theme of medical or doctor mistakes, particularly when it comes to their finances, career, maybe even relationships. Now, in the previous episode, I discussed five major mistakes, mainly about money. In this episode, I'm going to veer a little bit to the left of that. I'm going to talk about the money aspect, but also talk about things like relationships, also will and estate planning, and a few other things that often doctors get wrong. And that has implications for their career. That has implications for their insurance. That has implications for their investments, and ultimately has implications for their life. So let's get started. If you want me to discuss a specific topic or if you have a specific question, don't hesitate to contact me via Twitter or via Facebook. And remember, for those of you that are new to the channel, the three main aims: education, empowerment, and entertainment. Now, in the previous episode, we talked about particular money mistakes like lifestyle creep, just borrowing too much money, being underinsured. We also talked about not really having a written financial plan or not having a budget. And, you know, a lot of financial inertia stuff where doctors just don't pay themselves first. And a lot of these concepts and a lot of these mistakes can actually be extrapolated to many other professions. Accountancy, law, engineering, you name it. But I just find in my experience when I speak to doctors, those are the common things that I come across. It's almost like repetitive. I mean, every time I talk to them, most of them just don't invest. Most of them don't know how much fees they're paying. Most of them often overcommit when it comes to, you know, particularly buying houses. Now, having said that, remember, the people that may reach out to me for debriefing or perhaps commenting on online forums, etc., are probably the ones that are a little bit struggling when it comes to their finances. The people that never contact me probably never need to, because they're probably more comfortable. They've figured it out. They've probably listened to my podcast, or probably they have their own mentors and they pay themselves first and they've been investing for a very long time.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Long time. So granted that some of my optics may be a little bit one-sided, because you can imagine the people that reach out are the people that often have trouble making such decisions. In this episode, I want to continue on the theme and present five more mistakes that doctors often make. And you may actually be able to extrapolate this to some of your professions, even if you're not in the medical profession, because I think this is really relevant generally to life in general. So, number one, or number six, is not prioritizing relationships or planning their will and estate planning. This is not exactly a financial threat, but more of an existential threat. When I say relationships, I mean more about family relationships. Divorce is expensive, so it's worthwhile considering this when prioritizing work versus relationships. Having said this, it's also important to consider a binding financial agreement. It's something we don't usually think about, and it's a very touchy topic, but well worth learning about. I've done an episode on this specifically on episode 208. Now, something to think about is when it comes to relationships, being a doctor is not just about any other job. And I don't mean it from a professional point of view. And here's why. Med school is generally one of the longer university degrees out there, whether you do undergraduate or postgraduate. If you're doing postgraduate, you've got to do pre-med, which is around 3 to 4 years, and you've got to do postgraduate medicine, which is another 4 years plus your internship. You're looking at about potentially 7 to 9 years before you get your general registration. If you're doing pre-med, potentially you're doing about 5 to 6 years, and then you got to do internships. You're looking at about sort of 6 to 8 years in terms of getting your general registration. Now, internship on top of that is about a year with a 10 weekly assessment. Residency is around 1 to 4 years on top of that, depending on what you want to do. Registrarship is 2 to 7 years after that, depending on whatever specialty you want to do. And of course, fellowship is 1 to 2 years after that. Then you become a consultant called a junior consultant. Australian training times are longer than most other countries, and we can debate about this and whether it's necessary or not. For example, we don't see much pathology during our training compared to some of the other countries, which is why it's very common for Australian doctors to go overseas for fellowships to get a broader experience, mostly to the United States, North America, and also Western Europe. Now, I did a four-month term actually in India during my junior years, and during that time, say, lightning strikes, I saw them, gunshot wounds, I saw them, stabbings, I saw them, I probably helped with three splenectomies and delivered multiple babies. You just don't get that level of high acuity training in Australia, so we often need to train for longer periods of time to finesse our skills. We just don't see the volume. This means there's a lot of time outside of the home. This also means a fair bit of dedication. Some specialties, you practically live at the hospital. That's why back in the day, we used to call them house surgeons or hospital medical officers. Even now, some of the hospitals around Australia call doctors hospital medical officers from traditional times when we used to actually live in the hospital and work in the hospital. Yes, all of these changes with time, but it's still not the same as an 8-to-5 profession with a lot of weekends off. There have been attempts at making medicine an 8-to-5 job, but it just doesn't work. So why not just marry other doctors? Wouldn't that just be easier as they understand the profession better? Some people do, but it doesn't excuse or detract from the risks of breakup in marriages or relationships. So investing financially is very useful, but investing in relationships is probably just as important. Number seven is just training for far too long, which is an opportunity cost. This is something I've seen quite a bit. What do I mean? I think doctors need to understand their skill sets early in their career. The people that do are ahead of their game. The people that don't are not ahead of their game. It's as simple as that. Every year you keep training in a specialty which isn't going to get you anywhere is a wasted opportunity and an opportunity cost. I know this might sound harsh, but I'll say it again. Not every doctor can do every specialty. I've seen some doctors try and do a specialty which they simply are not good at. I could never be a pathologist myself. I'm just not good at microscopy and anatomical pathology. Radiology. I am just not good at radiology, except for basic interpretation of ultrasounds or x-rays or CTs. So I did not pursue that. I could never be an obstetrician or gynecologist. I'm just not good at women's health. Psychiatry? Not very good. Not for me. I've decided all of these specialties very early on in my career are off limits. And I think understanding this and not persisting and barking up the wrong tree is a good idea and will save you a lot of time. Now, just a clarification, that doesn't mean that I avoided patients that had women's health issues. That doesn't mean that I avoided patients with mental health issues. That doesn't mean I avoided patients that needed radiology. And it definitely doesn't mean that I did not look at histopathology reports and interpret them. That's different. I'm still able to do those things when I need to, but it's not those specialties that I enjoy. So I did not pursue training in those areas. I didn't ask for an obstetrics and gynecology rotation. I didn't ask for a psychiatry rotation. That's what I mean. But today, if there's an obstetrics and gynecology patient, I'd be able to treat them. Today, if there was a psych patient, I can deal with that. If I needed to speak to an anatomical pathologist and explain myself so they can report on a histology, I can do that also. If I needed to pick up the phone and speak to a consultant radiologist and explain my position about my patient from a clinical perspective, so that gives them inputs and they can actually have better outputs when it comes to radiology reporting, I can do that now. Now, what do I mean by opportunity cost? Doctors' incomes are quite low during their training time for the hours they do. Therefore, this means they don't have much disposable income to invest. The longer you train, the lower the income, and the investing runway is shorter and shorter. Comparing this to other professions who usually reach their peak earnings a lot earlier. We know time and time again, time is the most important thing when it comes to investing. So the longer we leave to invest, the lesser we will have in terms of overall wealth and retirement portfolio. Many doctors have had this thought in their head, I'll be a consultant one day and we'll make a lot of money than now, so I can wait to invest. That is a red flag. Some doctors will never become consultants because they'll never get into a training program. There are doctors out there who are permanent locums, career medical officers or whatnot. They won't settle on a training program. They won't perhaps pass exams or won't get through the training rotations. And life just happens. Health crises, family crises, burdens, financial burdens, whatever it is. So investing early and choosing your career pathway early and from a specialty perspective, focusing on your strengths and knowing your weaknesses is really important. So if you're a medical student, intern, resident, and you're listening in, make sure you focus on your strengths. Make sure you try and improve on your weaknesses. But fundamentally, and I'll say it again, not every doctor can do every specialty. Full stop. Now, number 8, my problems will be solved when I become a consultant. You just become more of what you already are. Money doesn't solve all your problems. It only solves money problems. Money also makes you who you already are and exaggerates it. If you're not a nice person now and you don't have any money, then money is likely to make that worse. If you're a selfless person now and don't have any money, then money is likely to make this even more obvious. The risk of waiting until I become a consultant is a huge risk. You can't teach behaviours later in life as easily as you can earlier in life. We know this as parents and children. Furthermore, the risk also is that life happens. By the time you become a consultant, if you end up in a relationship or plan for kids, then this just takes and dominates your life. Then the next thing is lifestyle creep. Schooling. Then eventually the risk is 10 years later. You haven't started investing or having maximized your investments. And we all know that's a huge risk in the medical profession. I've spoken about training time earlier in this episode. So if you're a junior doctor and just banking on becoming a consultant to solve your problems, it's not as easy and simply won't work. Make sure you plan for it. Make sure you execute it. And don't think consultant life is as easy as it sounds like. Often when you become a consultant, the hard work really just begins because now the buck stops with you. Now, we'll just take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to look at the last 2 mistakes, some of the most popular ones that I've spoken to a lot of doctors, and we'll discuss them and summarize the episode. Be right back.
If you're after personal financial advice, don't get it from a podcast. If you would like help based on your own personal situation, head over to sortyourmoneyout.com, click Get Help, and we'd be happy to introduce you to one of our trusted advisors. Our panel of advisors, mortgage brokers, and accountants work with clients all over Australia so they can connect with you wherever you are. That's sortyourmoneyout.com and click Get Help.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, we're back. Number 9. Remember, this is part 2 of the 2-part series on money mistakes that doctors make. Failing to obtain soft skills. This is a really big factor. I put up a post on social media feed about this in recent times, if maybe you've come across it on Twitter or Facebook. And the question was as simple as this. It was from a patient's perspective. Would you prefer to have technical skills as a doctor or soft skills as a doctor? It created a fair bit of discussion, mostly comments from doctors who felt soft skills is most important in order to become a good clinician. The thing is, technical skills, medical knowledge can be taught. But soft skills or emotional intelligence is much harder to be taught. It's probably worth it to discuss what soft skills are more broadly. Soft skills are basically non-technical skills that impact your performance in the workplace. Soft skills is something you can demonstrate during interviews and general interaction with your colleagues, or in this case, your patients too. Some of the soft skills you can possess are interpersonal skills, communication skills, listening skills, time management, problem solving, leadership, empathy towards others and your patients. When you think about what a doctor does, we deal with our colleagues of various specialties and disciplines, but we also deal with our patients as well. In my opinion, soft skills can't be taught very easily. As humans, we revert to our baseline level of functioning. You can't fake empathy, for example. You either have it or you don't. But if you try hard enough, understand what soft skills are, you can potentially do some training programs in order to understand it and try and find ways to relate to your profession and learn those skills. It's quite difficult, but it's possible. So what's the big deal? Why is it important for doctors to possess some soft skills? Now, this may sound really obvious, but I think it's important to go down this pathway. Think about it like this. Supposing you work in a team environment like the emergency department or the surgical facilities like in theatre. If you have amazing technical skills, that is a very, very good thing. Don't get me wrong. As a surgeon, as an ED specialist, as an anaesthetist, as a proceduralist, you need technical skills. But part of working in a team is also having those open communication skills, leadership, and soft skills to bring your colleagues and patients along with the journey. A disorganized surgeon or an ED doctor is quite terrible to work with. Believe me, I've worked with both. It is not uncommon that some doctors and nurses just don't work with some senior doctors if they're rostered on. If you're a senior doctor listening in, this is true. It happens a lot. How many times have you heard, I will not work with this surgeon in Theatre 1 because they are just disorganized and they just don't know what they're doing? They might be a great operator, but the theatre is always chaos. How many times have you heard people complaining about the senior doctor in the emergency department? Because when they're on, the floor is absolutely crazy. Nothing is managed. Everything is 4-hour breach. We hear these stories all the time. It is not uncommon that during some days in theatre, again, things don't flow because the scrub nurse or the theatre nurse is just difficult to work with. It is not uncommon that junior doctors just hate working with some administrative staff who make their lives as miserable as possible. So this phenomenon is not just with doctors, it is with healthcare workers or any profession. When I come to work or used to come to work, and I see some certain people on the shift, I'd be like, today, it's going to be a great day. When I used to come to work and I saw some people in theatre when I was a surgical registrar, I'd be like, today, it's going to be a terrible day. So even though having technical skills is important, having some soft skills is also very important. And believe me, I'm sure a lot of people working with Devraga probably had the same feeling. And I'm sorry if I made you that way. Now, sometimes when this question comes up, people always have an all or none response. I would much rather have a surgeon who can operate than that can make me feel very good. But that doesn't work like that. I think soft skills is a fluid situation. That is, there are situations where you need gangster technical skills. But there are situations where soft skills are also important. So even during one patient encounter, you can switch between the two. A surgeon during a trauma surgery needs to have the skills to do it. Having soft skills and encouraging the intubated patient is not going to help when they're bleeding out. But the surgeon also needs to possess the leadership and communication skills to make sure their anaesthetist, their theatre nurses know exactly what's happening so the operation flows, otherwise the patient suffers with a potentially bad outcome. The surgeon needs to have the soft skills to encourage the junior doctors who may spot something abnormal, perhaps during operating, and is afraid to speak up for fear of getting shouted down, to encourage them to speak up. Then the surgeon needs to possess the skills to break the news post-op to the family member and the patient the operative findings. They may have found an incidental tumour. The operation may not have gone according to plan. The outcomes may be significantly adverse to what their trajectory planned. Then, when the patient goes back to their GP for review, the GP needs to possess the technical skills to see the patient post-operative surgery, but also have the soft skills to explore the possible mental health impact on their major operation. Remember, the GP carries the burden of the patient for a very long time. So it's a very team environment. So you can see that the question isn't correct, I suspect. Which one would you have, soft skills or technical skills? The reality is you'll need a bit of both. The reality is it'll change based on the situation, based on the specialty, based on the clinical encounter, based on the urgency, based on the team environment. The reality is there are patient and work adverse events and issues due to poor soft skills for some doctors, nurses, and healthcare workers. It's a given. People that have poor soft skills are difficult to work with, and work culture suffers. Have a look around your work culture. Can you see some of these problems? Soft skills are not easily taught and comes naturally to some clinicians compared to others. The number one complaint I have reviewed is not usually about technical knowledge or competence. It's not about wrong decision-making when it comes to treatment. A lot of the time, it's always secondary to poor soft skills and just not reading the room, just not communicating with their patients or the families, just not communicating with their team members. Hope this clarifies this subtopic of soft skills. And if you're a junior doctor, you need to master this early on in the career. As Dev Raga often says, just don't be an arsehole. And number 10, the last one, just complicating their financial life. One of the good things about being a doctor, apart from actual rewarding work, despite what you hear, most doctors do the profession because they like it and they donate a lot of their time to the profession without actually getting paid. Actually, junior doctors in Victoria, a recent survey have shown they donate between 10 and 17 hours per week to the profession without getting paid. That's almost half a full-time job of any other profession, and I've not heard similar things in other professions, which are paid professions. I don't think our friendly law colleagues donate 17 hours of their time per week. I'm not saying everyone needs to donate it, but I'm just saying most doctors do medicine for the right reason. I don't believe this BS that a lot of doctors do it for the money. That's rubbish. That's nonsense. That's what you see on whatever media that you want to see. That's not the truth. The people that come to work, that work around me, that I've been over the last many, many years as a doctor, they come to work because they enjoy it, despite getting relatively poorly paid for the number of hours they work. Anyway, apart from the rewarding nature of the job, the pay is actually not that great, depending on the specialty. So we have a real opportunity to make decent income on top of the not-so-great income, so locuming and other opportunities, for example, and save a lot of it, not spend too much money, and invest it for the future. But time and time again, doctors fall for many traps in the investing world. Fad investors, fad investing outcomes, complex structures, setting up unnecessary companies because their accountant said so, and setting up trusts. I met a GP once who was day trading in his lunch break during consulting and lost a fair bit of money, then wondered why that was the case. We're doctors. We're not financial analysts. So sticking to our circle of competence is really important. I won't dwell on this very much, but it's a recurrent pattern I've heard of and seen. Doctors wanting to start cafes or bread tops. Doctors wanting to open restaurants. Again, circle of competence. I'm not saying setting up companies or other businesses or trusts is not useful, but do it wisely. Don't do it just because someone else told you so. The other major thing I've found with some doctors and some specialties, is this is especially true for GPs, is I'll become a GP and just set up a practice. Red flag. Just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you can run a medical practice. Just because you're a doctor doesn't mean you're a great business person. Running a medical practice requires business skills, economical skills, financial skills, soft skills, as well as clinical skills and managerial skills. It's not for the faint-hearted. I stay away from the practice side of things because I suck at running a business. That's why I don't own any businesses. Nor do I have the temperament to be a manager in the private sector. It's a whole nother ballgame. So, that's about it for this part two episode. And from part one and part two, we've discussed 10 mistakes that doctors make routinely when it comes to their money, investing, career, and their time and relationships. Have you listened to yourself and thought to yourself, damn, I made some of these mistakes? We all have. For the juniors, here's a blueprint of what not to do. Now, that's it for this episode. Remember to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you may be using, or leave a 5-star rating on all of the platforms. That's even better. And please leave a positive review. The more ratings and reviews you leave, the more people get access to these podcasts, so please keep them coming. My name's Dev Raga, and this is Dev Raga Personal Finance. And until next time, please make sure you stay safe.
We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the lands on which we live and work and pay respects to their elders past, present and emerging. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to this podcast. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement, target market determination, and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, and Glenn James are authorised representatives of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451289.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.